Today is Wednesday, February 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ruafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden vows the U.S. is ready, quote, no matter what happens, unquote, in Ukraine.
Washington is talking tough as Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to deploy thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border, not just within Russian territory, but also in Belarus.
Several NATO members send troops and hardware to allies in Europe as tensions with Russia escalate.
Failed rains over the past 3 years have dried up water wells, killing livestock and crops, pushing hundreds of thousands of children and their families over the edge.
And the UN warns that 3 years of successive drought in Ethiopia's lowland regions threatens the lives of millions of people. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is willing to talk more to ease tensions over Ukraine, but that the U.S. and its allies have ignored Russia's top security demands. In his first comments on the standoff with the West over Ukraine in more than a month, Putin said Tuesday that the Kremlin is still studying the U.S. and NATO's response to the Russian security demands received last week, but he said it was clear that the West has ignored the Russian demands that NATO not expand to Ukraine and other ex-Soviet nations refrain from deploying offensive weapons near Russia and roll back its deployment to Eastern Europe. Russia has amassed over 100,000 troops along the border of Ukraine. Will Russia invade Ukraine? While the world waits, the war of words is picking up steam with top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia going head-to-head at the United Nations, and President Joe Biden vowing that the U.S. is ready, quote, no matter what happens, unquote. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Strong words from U.S. President Joe Biden as the drama deepens between Moscow and Washington.
We continue to urge diplomacy as the best way forward. But with Russia's continuing its buildup of its forces around Ukraine, we are ready no matter what happens.
Washington is talking tough as Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to deploy thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border, not just within Russian territory, but also in Belarus. The White House says more than 105,000 Russian troops nearly encircle Ukraine. Russia objects to Ukraine's attempt to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and has demanded that the U.S., the most powerful member of the Collective Security Alliance, bar Ukraine's entry. The top U.S. diplomat at the United Nations on Monday called for the Security Council to discuss the matter publicly after months of private discussions between the U.S. and Russia. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is U.S. Ambassador to the U.N.
The situation we're facing in Europe is urgent and dangerous, and the stakes for Ukraine and for every UN member state could not be higher. Russia's actions strike at the very heart of the UN Charter. This is as clear and consequential a threat to peace and security as anyone can imagine.
Russia fired back with its ambassador saying it does not intend to invade.
You want it to happen. You're waiting for it to happen, as if you want to make your words become a reality. This is despite the fact that we are constantly rejecting these allegations, and this is despite the fact that no threat of a planned invasion into Ukraine from the lips of any Russian politician or public figure over all of this period has been made.
The dispute between two nuclear-armed nations is about more than differing worldviews, says analyst Angela Stent, speaking to VOA via Skype. A stable Europe is central to U.S. interests. And sending more than $200 million worth of security assistance to non-NATO Ukraine is part of that.
It's not only ideology, it's security. I mean, it's, you know, a system of alliances and a stable European continent, which are in the U.S.'s interests. We don't live in isolation. You know, we're not on we're a very large island with two neighbors, right? We're a continent. But so it's more than that. It's not about ideology. It's about power politics, but it's also about principles. Which do have to do with territorial integrity and sovereignty.
Meanwhile, Russia and top U.S. rival China have become ever closer. Beijing expressed its dissatisfaction when Russia invaded Georgia as China was hosting the 2008 Olympics. The Chinese capital will host the Winter Games starting this week. With the U.S. threatening heavy sanctions against Russia, and even against Putin himself, Moscow will need support from the world's second largest economy if it invades Ukraine. Analysts say this could play out slowly, as the Olympics take center stage and Washington continues to remind Moscow of the consequences of an invasion. Andrew Lozen, a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, via Zoom.
If it does move into Ukraine, then the economic measures that the United States and others are going to bring to bear, you know, to a certain extent, will push them even further into a junior relationship with China, which is just going to hurt their economy in the long run. I don't really see a lot of strong outcomes here. So that's one of the reasons why I think that a diplomatic outcome might still be on the table, but Russia's going to try to let the clock run as long as possible to let us feel uncomfortable.
And so, as the games begin in Beijing and military positioning continues on both sides of Ukraine's border, the diplomatic standoff between distant rivals endures. Anita Pell, VOA News, Washington.
Several NATO member states are sending troops and hardware to allies in Eastern Europe as tensions with Russia escalate. The United States has put several thousand troops on alert. Moscow has over 100,000 troops massed at the Ukraine border, and the West fears an imminent Russian invasion, which the Kremlin denies. Henry Ridgewell looks at what NATO's military response means.
A show of solidarity. Four Danish F-16 fighter jets landed in Lithuania last week to bolster NATO's air policing mission in the Baltic. Since Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea in 2014, NATO has deployed around 5,000 troops in Eastern Europe in what the alliance terms an enhanced forward presence. The US has put an additional 8,500 troops on standby. Speaking to reporters Friday, US President Joe Biden said he would be moving US troops to Eastern Europe and NATO countries in the near term. France announced plans to deploy hundreds more troops to Romania, while Spain, the Netherlands, and Germany are also considering sending more troops, aircraft, and warships. Britain has supplied around 2,000 anti-tank weapons to Ukraine and is expected to offer further deployments to NATO allies this week. British Defence Minister Ben Wallace met his Hungarian counterpart in Budapest Monday.
I think it's important when it comes to military deployment that we signal to President Putin that the very thing he fears, which is more NATO closer to Russia, would be a consequence of a strategic error of invading a sovereign country such as Ukraine.
NATO has no plans to deploy combat troops to Ukraine, notes Julie Norman, a security analyst at University College London.
And those NATO troops that are in those border states are really there more for preparedness and for defensive and deterrence capability rather than the expectation for a direct conflict or direct combat.
NATO says it is responding to Russian aggression. Moscow called the response hysteria. Russia has around 100,000 troops deployed close to the Ukrainian border. Thousands more arrived in Belarus for joint military exercises this week. Evelyn Farkas is a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia.
NATO itself has had to respond to a new threat that Russia posed by putting additional forces into Belarus, which of course shares a border with Poland, Latvia, and Lithuania, which are NATO allies.
NATO's deployments could ratchet up tensions further with Russia's president, says Norman.
One of Putin's key demands in all of this is the drawdown of NATO troops and weaponry from those same eastern states. So the fact that there is more buildup there is going to be seen not as an act of defense, but an act of offense and provocation by Russia.
Meanwhile, the flurry of diplomatic efforts to avoid war continues. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is due to visit Ukraine this week and hold talks on the phone with Russia's president. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett repeated previous remarks in which he stressed that he would never meet with Palestinian negotiators, namely Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. He added, quote, "I reject the creation of a Palestinian state. I will never allow carrying out political talks on the borders," unquote, stressing, quote, "there will be no new Oslo Accords." Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, discussed with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawi whether such a position could impede any future attempts to revive the peace talks.
The statements, frankly, of the Israeli prime minister are not surprising at all. This has been his legacy all along as a politician. It's been his position and the position of his affiliates. He's very close to the militant and radical settlers. He headed different organizations relevant to them. So there is absolutely no surprise in his position. The surprise is the fact that he is the prime minister of Israel at this time, and the fact that this administration has a totally different position, totally opposed to the ideas that were articulated by Mr. Bennett. Now, when you look, for example, at the statement today by the State Department, the fact that the Secretary of State, Blinken, called Abu Mazen, Mr. Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, to talk with him about improving relations between the U.S. and the Palestinians, which has improved, actually, since the beginning of this administration, but to continue to focus on that with the declared objective, as the Secretary of State said, or the statement from the State Department indicated, that the Palestinians and the Israelis alike deserve to live safely and securely and enjoy, and I'm quoting the State Department, equal measures of security, freedom, and prosperity. The question that begs to be answered, how can you pursue freedom and prosperity under Israeli occupation? It can't be done. So if the current government is unable to break that ideological deadlock, and if Mr. Bennett insists on continuing his position, of course, hiding behind the fig leaf that his government is somewhat too weak and that any overture toward the Palestinians will bring it down, if that's the coalition, the best coalition that Israel could come up with, then neither Israel nor the Palestinians are going to have peace, and neither the U.S. is going to have the option that this administration has made one of its main objectives in the region to resume some sort of a peace negotiations process in the region.
There were meetings between Abbas and Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz and Foreign Minister Yair Lapid on resuming security cooperation between the two sides. However, Bennett stated the two ministers do not have any power to discuss the political issue with the Palestinians. What do you make of that?
I think these meetings are a futile attempt to pacify the Palestinian side, aside from the gesture itself, which was essentially, I think it wasn't an Israeli gesture. I think it was an American gesture toward the Palestinians. The meeting took place at the urging of administration. And considering the fact that the meeting took place in the context of those statements by the prime minister, the meeting doesn't make sense. Israel spent most of its time trying to avoid any spin whatsoever inside Israel that this was a step toward peace, denying that it has anything to do with political negotiations, anything to do with borders, anything to do with Palestinian rights, and instead that it was simply a coordination of security-related issues. And even though they took some measures, again, under duress, under U.S. pressure, whether it's basically providing the PA with some of the funds that Israel was withholding from Palestinian tax revenues, legalizing the status of at least 9,000 to 10,000 Palestinian residents. And so all these steps are much ado about nothing. You know, so when you go back to the American objective to bring peace closer, one looks at these meetings, whether with foreign minister or whether with the defense minister or any other Israeli official meeting with counterparts on the Palestinian side, and notice at the same time that we are not one millimeter closer to peace, one has to question the validity of these meetings.
That's Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns 3 years of successive drought in Ethiopia's lowland regions of Afar, Oromia, the southern nations, nationalities and peoples, and Somali is threatening the lives and livelihoods of millions of people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Failed rains over the past 3 years have dried up water wells, killing livestock and crops, pushing hundreds of thousands of children and their families over the edge. UNICEF predicts 6.8 million people will need life-saving humanitarian aid by mid-March. It warns conditions could get even worse if the hoped-for rainy season in April does not come. Speaking from the capital, Addis Ababa, UNICEF representative in Ethiopia, Gianfranco Rotigliano, says the impact of acute food and water shortages already is visible, especially in the two most affected regions, Somali and Oromia.
We have already some more than 220,000 children, 100,000 pregnant or lactating women that need urgent nutrition support. In the regions, the rate of acute malnutrition is already at 20%, which is well above the rate that we have in global emergencies, which is estimated to 15%.
UNICEF estimates 850,000 children across the four regions will be severely malnourished this year due to conflict, drought, and a poor economy. Rotigliano says nutrition centers must be urgently improved so acutely malnourished children can be quickly admitted and treated correctly.
All of that is something that should be done within the next 2-3 weeks. So it is extremely urgent that we move on swiftly and rapidly, and we do not wait for the usual situation in which we see, you know, the devastating effect of famine and all of that.
UNICEF says more than 155,000 children in Somali and Oromia regions have dropped out of school to help find and fetch water in the parched landscape for their families and cattle. It warns children who are out of school are at risk of exploitation. The Children's Agency is appealing for nearly $32 million to provide life-saving support to more than 2 million people in the four lowland regions over the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tensions between Mali and former colonial power France have hit a new low, with the military government giving the French ambassador until Thursday to leave the country. Annie Risenberg speaks to analysts about where relations are headed in this report from Mali's capital, Bamako.
The French ambassador to Mali, Joël Maier, has been given 72 hours from Monday to leave the West African country. Maier was summoned to the Malian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in response to remarks made by French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian. On Friday, Le Drian said Mali's military junta, which seized power last May, was out of control and illegitimate. Speaking on state television ORTM on Monday evening, Mali's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abdoulaye Diop, acknowledged that the ambassador has been ordered to depart. Diop said the ambassador is welcome to return if France changes its position on Mali, but stated that France calling into question the legitimacy of the Malian government is a line that neither ECOWAS nor the UN has crossed. He says this declaration is to call into question the legality and the legitimacy of the authorities with whom precisely the French ambassador is accredited. This creates a very difficult situation, because you cannot be accredited by an authority that you do not recognize yourself. Anna Schmouder is a Sahel researcher at the Klingendael Institute, a think tank in the Netherlands focused on international affairs. She spoke via a messaging application from The Hague.
Well, I would say after this escalation and the expulsion of the French ambassador, retreat of the entirety of the French Barkhane mission from Mali is definitely on the table.
Operation Barkhane is a French-led anti-insurgent operation in the Sahel launched in 2014. Schmouder says any changes to the Barkhane mission in Mali will also likely affect the French-led European Takuba Task Force, and possibly even the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, MINUSMA. But she adds that it's too early to say what exactly could be the political fallout, because such a significant decline in Mali-France relations is without precedent. Kalilu Sidibe is a professor of political science at the University of Legal and Political Sciences of Bamako and a political analyst. He said the expulsion of the ambassador could push France to relocate the Barkhane base, which is currently in Gao, Mali, to another country in the Sahel. He says despite the diplomatic setback, France plays an important role in the fight against Islamist groups. Via a messaging application from Bamako, Sidibe also said that aside from the military implications, humanitarian projects could now be at risk. France invests and intervenes in several development and humanitarian programs in Mali, he says. If they suspend the financing of these, this will have a negative impact in terms of livelihood for the community, in terms of access to basic resources, social services, sanitation, hygiene, education, and health. Both Schmouder and Sidibe underscore that the expulsion of the ambassador does not signify a total rupture in diplomatic relations. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Prolonged heavy gunfire around the government palace in Guinea-Bissau's capital has signaled the coup attempt in this West African country with a long history of military takeovers. The state broadcaster has reported that the shooting has damaged the government's building and that, quote, the invaders are holding officials. President Omaro Sissoko Embalo, a former army general, was believed to be inside the building at the time of the attack. He was declared the winner of the 2020 election, though the results were contested by his opponent. Since getting independence from Portugal in 1974, Guinea-Bissau has experienced four coup d'etats and more than a dozen attempted coups. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Mask mandates and regular rapid antigen tests are part of COVID-19 safe plans for the start Tuesday of the new year in Australia's most populous state, New South Wales. Thousands of daily new coronavirus infections and dozens of deaths are being reported in Australia, but authorities say it is safe for classes to resume. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Schools in Australia were closed for long periods during the first 2 years of the pandemic. In New South Wales, children and teachers will be screened for COVID-19 twice a week under a plan to keep schools open. Older students and staff must also wear masks. State Premier Dominic Perrottet has conceded that there will be bumps along the way. New South Wales Education Minister Sarah Mitchell on Tuesday had this message of support for students on the first day of term.
It's a hard time living in the middle of a global pandemic, but we are all here to support you. And every single one of those people that I spoke about, your families, your teachers, your principals, we are all doing this to support you and your education. So good luck for the school year. It's an exciting time, first day, and we can't wait to see all the amazing things that you achieve in 2022.
Similar mask mandates and surveillance testing for COVID-19 apply in the state of Victoria. But the rules vary across the country. Parents in Queensland, Tasmania and South Australia aren't required to regularly test their children. But officials have said that students and staff shouldn't attend school if they're unwell or have coronavirus symptoms. The start of term in Queensland has been delayed by 2 weeks to avoid the predicted peak of the Omicron wave and to allow more time for students to receive their vaccinations. Classes are scheduled to resume on February 7. A study published in late January in the Medical Journal of Australia shows how the pandemic has affected children's mental and physical health. Researchers from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the University of Melbourne warned that children were facing a generation-defining disruption because of lockdowns and school closures over the past 2 years. Australia has recorded 2.1 million coronavirus cases since the pandemic began, according to government data. 3,758 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hong Kong media leaders and journalists adjust to the challenging environment as they navigate a national security law instituted by Beijing. VOA's Laurel Bowman has more.
First of all, in June 2021 was Apple Daily and its founder, Jimmy Lai. The newspaper that praised Hong Kong's 2019 pro-democracy movement was loathed by Beijing's leadership. With its executives charged under the national security law, the paper's assets were frozen. Lai, an outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, is now in prison. For many Hong Kongers, the newspaper's demise sent a chill. Stephen Liu is a Hong Kong resident.
It's like death, because Hong Kong is supposed to have freedom of press and speech. If the last organization that speaks for Hong Kong disappears, I don't want to live here anymore.
Apple Daily was not the last. In late December, National Security Police raided the pro-democracy news website Stand News. Its assets were frozen and boxes of evidence, including computers, phones, and journalistic materials, were carted away. Crowds showed up in support of two editors who had been charged with sedition. Their arrests came even after Stan News had said it would cease operations. The risk of lawsuits is changing how media think, says Ronson Chan, a former Stan News journalist who chairs the Hong Kong Journalists Association. Police spent 5 hours searching his sparse apartment. Chan spoke to VOA via Skype.
No one could escape from the law, from the NSL. So you may bear very high risk if you do something very sensitive or something. So I feel quite sad about the future of this journalism in Hong Kong.
A week later, Citizen News threw in the towel. Daisy Lee was chief editor at Citizen News.
I am unsure whether a story, a piece of news, or a sentence will violate a new regulation under the changing news environment. If I can't confidently let my reporters continue to do what we are doing, then I should stop. As a leader, I am responsible for journalists, after all.
She added that journalists need to feel safe in their jobs. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam says Western governments critical of the news outlets' closures don't understand Hong Kong law. Journalists are respected, but they must practice their trade properly, she says.
If you breach the law but package yourself as a practitioner in the press, then we need to see through that, to be able to tell what's actually happening, and the law enforcement department should take action.
Press freedom advocates say it's a precarious time to be a journalist in Hong Kong.
I think here in Hong Kong at the moment, journalists are distressed, they're frightened, they're despairing, but they're trying to get on with their jobs as best they can. I mean, it's a tough time if you know Hong Kong the way it used to be. This place used to be probably the freest in Asia and this part of the world for the press.
Now, with pro-democracy media closing and laws making journalists wary of covering political news, that freedom appears limited. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
As Beijing prepares for the opening of the Winter Olympics this week, scientists are warning that the future of the Games is under threat because of climate change. Harold Ridgewell reports.
Zhang Jiakou, 200 kilometers northwest of Beijing, will host freestyle skiing and snowboarding, cross-country skiing and ski jumping. The problem is, it rarely snows. So for several weeks, snow machines have been churning out artificial snow. Site manager Jacques Fournier has a difficult job.
Here is no humidity, it's very dry, and it's a lot of wind.
For the first time, the Beijing Winter Olympics will use almost 100% artificial snow. But a new report warns athletes' safety could be at risk. Madeline Orr, a sports ecologist at Britain's Loughborough University, is a co-author of the report.
In sports like biathlon or cross-country skiing or any of the freestyle events where an athlete is flinging themselves into the air, flipping around and falling, you would want the surface to be a little softer. And the problem with artificial snow is that it's about 70% ice compared to natural snow, which is about 30% ice. And so the surface is much, much harder.
American snowboarder Taylor Gold is preparing for Beijing during his first Olympics in the Russian resort of Sochi in 2014. He recalls the halfpipe melting.
They were spraying some chemicals on it to try to get it to stay in shape, but you go back and watch that event, it's clear it was really warm. It was not ideal for snowboarding.
Critics say the climate of both Sochi and Beijing are unsuitable to host the Winter Olympics. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This has been International Edition. I'm the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Junior Roth in Washington, wishing you a great day.
America, Washington, Bob.